yet without sin. I think it's pretty clear from both this particular story in Matthew 4 and in other stories in the Gospels leading up to the cross that Jesus was not given a free pass by Satan when he walked among us. The devil knew who he was, even if he didn't understand all of the plans that God had for Jesus. He knew who he was. Because you notice here in chapter 4, if you are the Son of God, if you are the Son of God, if you are the Son of God, and I don't think that's a, I'm not really sure if you are or not, but if this is true of you, then you need to prove it in this way, kind of idea. Satan threw the kitchen sink at him. Jesus, to his credit, in all of these temptations and in the ones to come, did not use his power to exempt himself from experiencing the full weight of those trials. I think it's so encouraging for us to notice that Matthew 4 is at the very, very beginning of Jesus' ministry. Right out of the gate. As soon as, end of chapter 3, he comes up out of the water, the very next story, and you notice chapter 4 begins with then. We're meant to see this connection here between chapter 4 and chapter 3. Right after that, he is not going to a couch with a soft drink and servants fanning him. He's going into a very harsh environment, physical environment, to undergo some harsh spiritual conditions with the tempter coming after him. This famous scene is not an accident. Verse 1 explicitly says he was led by the Spirit to go to this place. The same Spirit who had just come upon him and anointed him as king in the previous chapter, in chapter 3. You know, it's interesting, later on in chapter 6, as Jesus is teaching us how to pray, he'll say, what we need to pray is, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Is this not a case where Jesus himself was led into temptation? I think in chapter 6, the point is not, God's never going to take us to a dark place, and we need to make sure that he doesn't and pray that he doesn't, but for God to help us when we go into the valleys of the shadow of death. God will take us to places that test our endurance, but we need to ask him for the support to not allow the evil one to overcome us, and he gives us that protection as he gave to his only begotten son in this passage. So Matthew 4 isn't just about Jesus and what Jesus did. Matthew 4 is also about how God protects all of us, if we take the kind of road that Jesus took, if we do not try to take shortcuts, if we do not try to cheat. That's what we're going to be talking about today. But first, what I want to do as we get into Matthew 4 is I want us to appreciate this scene and what is going on in it. And to do that, I think we need to make some connections to the Old Testament, and we need to make some connections to what happens later on in Matthew. So first, Old Testament background. What Jesus is doing here is he's imitating a couple of things. He's imitating what happened with Moses as Moses went on Mount Sinai, and he talks about this in Deuteronomy 9 as he backtracks and looks back at 40 years before that moment when he preaches that sermon, but also this is imitating what happened to the Israelites. But first, Deuteronomy 9:9, Moses says, when I went up on the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant that the Lord made with you, I remained on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water. That's clearly miraculous. I mean, you can make it without food for a while. And I read one commentary during the last week that said that 40 days is about the length of time that a human body can go through without bread until it reaches the point where it causes permanent damage. I don't know about that. I'm not a medical doctor, and I don't think the guy that I was reading was either. So I'm curious about that. But you can make it without bread and food for a while. You cannot make it without drink for very long. And so Moses is living proof that man does not have to live on bread alone, because he had no physical nourishment when he was up on that mountain. And so in a similar way, Jesus goes to this desolate place, but then he's going to go to a mountain just right after this in chapter 5. And he's going to imitate Moses in explaining this new covenant. He's going to imitate Moses in leading the people out of a greater slavery than the slavery that Moses led the Israelites out of in Egypt. And so Jesus is going to spend the same amount of time here. You notice the same phrase is used there in verse 2, after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he's depriving himself of food. He felt the full effects of that, as Moses surely did too. Verse 2 flat out says, he was hungry. And then when we think about what happens in the book of Numbers, this 40 number clearly imitates what happens in the wanderings that the Israelites went through. Remember, after the 12 spies came back and they said, well, we got some good news and we got some bad news. Good news is it's a fantastic land. Bad news is there's no way we're going to take it. You remember how God had just had enough. There have been so many instances of complaining and griping about no leeks and onions and no food and water when we exactly want it. After they try to pick a new leader to go back to Egypt, God finally pulls the plug and says, with the exception of a few, this entire generation is going to live outside of the promised land in the wilderness until they died as punishment for failing to have the kind of faith that God expected them to have because he was with them. And so he sets the time period of the wandering at 40 years. Jesus' 40 days reminds us of that as well. But as I mentioned last week, Jesus is not going to fail his wilderness test. He's not going to rebel as they all did. He is going to trust his Father in this really vulnerable moment when he is genuinely hungry and desperately wanting food. So he imitates the past, but also in a really neat kind of way, he imitates what is coming in the rest of his ministry work in the rest of Matthew. So he's hungry, chapter 4, verse 2, but he's not going to make bread for himself. But later on, we see some ironies here. He's going to use his power to make bread for other people. And he's going to do it not once, but on two separate occasions in chapter 14 and in 15. We're going to get to those stories later. But people are going to come from all over to hear him preach and teach. They're going to be starving. I mean, they haven't gone for 40 days. But they're going to be really hungry. And Jesus is going to say, hey, what are we going to do for these people? And then he's going to provide them miraculous bread and multiply thousands and thousands of loaves so that other people can eat. But he's not going to do that for him. And then later on, and Luke hit the nail on the head with this during his Lord's Supper talk. At the end of the gospel, when he's taking his last Passover meal with his disciples, he breaks the unleavened bread, which they traditionally ate during the Passover meal, and he's handing it around the table. But instead of saying, now, we all got to be thinking about the Exodus night, as the Jews would do at Passover time, thinking about coming out of Egypt, coming out of slavery, he's passing the bread around, and he's saying, this is my body that I'm giving for you. Take this and think about me now, not just the Exodus, because I'm leading you out of a greater slavery and consuming the significance of that is the nourishment of your soul. And so in ways that look backwards and forwards, I think this moment shows that Jesus is intent on giving himself up and not on seizing opportunities for personal comfort, which as the Son of God, if anybody could do that, surely he had that power. But this is how he uses it. So I think we need to appreciate all this coming into this story. And now what I want to do is look at the temptation moments. We'll look at that quote in a second. So this first temptation that the devil gives to Jesus doesn't seem very serious on its face at first glance, right? I mean, it's not like the devil is saying, you know, Jesus, I want you to go knife somebody in the back today. If you were insanely hungry and you had the opportunity to turn some nearby object into a Culver's Deluxe with bacon, I mean, why wouldn't you do that? I mean, the common way that the world makes decisions is, does it hurt somebody else? If the answer is no, then why wouldn't you do that? But here, the devil isn't even talking about Culver's. He's not even saying, you know, you need to make a 7-course meal for yourself. I mean, you can do it. You can make some smoked salmon. You can make some creme brulee. You can make, I mean, anything that would cause your mouth to water. Any personal preference you've got, you can create it just by speaking words. The devil didn't say that, though. All the devil said was, just make a few loaves of bread. Because in the wilderness of the Old Testament, when they were wandering around for 40 years, what did they eat every day of their lives? What appeared outside of all of their tents? It was bread. It was manna from heaven. And so I think the unspoken implication here is, if he's not going to make that for you, if he's not going to take care of you, the way he took care of those worthless rebels out, then you had better take care of yourself. But Jesus responds with scripture, and not just any scripture. He responds with Deuteronomy all three times. But I think it's interesting that all three of these quotations are from the same area of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, as we often say, is a sermon that Moses gives to the Israelites right before he dies. But Deuteronomy 5 through 11 is a sermon within a sermon, where Moses is especially trying to teach the Israelites about the importance of faithful obedience to God's law. And so in this quote that Jesus is quoting from here in chapter 8, in the middle of that sermon within a sermon, he'll say this in Deuteronomy 8, "You shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man doesn't live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of God." Right now, in your life, I want you to ask yourself the question, what am I really hungry for right now? Is there anything that you don't have in this moment in this week, in this month, at this stage of your life, anything that you don't have that you believe you really do need to have in order to live. I recently saw on the news about a week or two ago that there's a very highly respected author and evangelical preacher who, as it turns out, recently said that he'd been conducting an 8-year affair with a married woman, even though he had been married to his spouse for 47 years when the affair began. And so he confessed that publicly. He has since withdrawn from all writing and all speaking. His ministry has closed down. And so all of this is in the background of my thoughts as I came to Matthew 4 and was thinking about hungering. That's a terrifying situation to me. How does that happen? I don't know all the specifics of his case, and it's really none of my business. But for just a moment, step into the mind of a spouse who gets emotionally attached to someone outside of his marriage because he feels like he's living in a wilderness. He might say something like this: "Well, look, when I'm at home, I'm not receiving what I'm created to need as a man." You know, Ephesians 5 says that wives should respect their husbands. And I feel like I'm not getting that kind of respect at home from her. When I get home from work, I just hear some complaints. I hear some criticisms. And when evening comes, she says no far more often than she says yes. And so you see, my marriage is a wilderness. And I'm so hungry. I'm starving for someone who notices and appreciates me, who listens eagerly to my thoughts, is happy to share a little bit of physical affection. It's not like I've committed adultery with this friend of mine at work. Yeah, we talk a lot. Sometimes we go on some coffee dates here and there, but that's fine, because if I have the power to make my life a little bit more bearable, a little bit more satisfying in the desert, then I'm going to do that. Because I've done a lot for the Lord, and I think I deserve a few perks here and there. It's not like I've created a tear in the multiverse. It's just a few loaves of bread. Is that too much to ask for? Now, what is wrong with that way of framing life? I think we could probably point to a lot of things that are wrong with that whole train of thought. But I wanna focus on one of those ideas. I think that whole line of thinking assumes that it's God's job to make sure that I don't get really hungry in my life. And that if I am really hungry for something that I think I really need, then that means He has failed me and I need to take the reins in some kind of way and create some satisfaction for myself. That if God doesn't feed me, then you'd bet that I'm going to feed myself. I think so much of who you are and who I am depends on what we do in a wilderness. How do you see the purpose of your, what is the purpose of your relationship with Jesus? How do you see that working out in your life? I really like this quotation from a guy named Heath Lambert. He wrote a book called Finally Free that I use in studies with other guys. And he said this: "Some in the church today believe and teach that Jesus' fundamental mission is to meet our perceived needs. So, for example, if you are lonely, Jesus came to be your friend. If you're single, Jesus came to be your companion. If you feel ugly, Jesus came to be your encourager. If you're broke, Jesus came to make you rich. Health and wealth, prosperity, gospel. If you're sick, Jesus came to make you well. What kind of Messiah are you really looking for? Someone to rescue you from your sins, to clean your soul, to give you new purpose, a new lens with which you can see the world, even as broken and messed up as it is? Or are you just looking for a Jesus who can make you happy on your terms? It's a challenging question, isn't it? Jesus rebuffs that temptation to cheat, to make bread for himself. And he also rebuffs this temptation that also looks a little weird on its face, to jump off the temple. But what I think is going on here is the devil saying, what you need to do, I mean, if you're going to start this massively difficult job, in whatever it is that you plan to do with this bringing in the kingdom of heaven business, you're going to start doing something like that and shaking up the earth, you'd better make sure that God has your back, don't you? And so you need to push him into showing his care for you right now. Do you remember the story of Gideon in the book of Judges? Do you remember how Gideon was appeared to by an angel as he is hiding in a wine press from the Midianites who would come in and just clean Israel out all the time? Do you remember how God kept telling Gideon and showing Gideon after miracle, miracle, miracle happens that I am with you, I've given you this mission, I've got your back, and Gideon, being the coward that he was, really had trouble understanding that and having faith in that? Well, that seems to be in the vein of what the devil is trying to get Jesus to do here. At first glance, it looks silly for him to invite Jesus to jump off a high building, but he is tempting Jesus to test God's resolution to deliver him from all harm. Demand that he provide for you in this specific kind of way. Yes, I know that at your baptism, the heavens opened and the Spirit came down and God's voice said, this is my beloved Son, well pleased in him, but make him prove it. Make him prove that you are beloved to him by saving your life with a miracle, by throwing yourself off the temple so that the angels can catch you, because doesn't that fit with Psalm 91 and the devil, as is often said about Matthew 4, the devil knows Scripture, and that's terrifying, because he might, in some cases, know it better than us if we're not careful. The devil doesn't understand all the ins and outs of God's plan for Jesus, but Jesus did. Jesus knew where all of this was going. Jesus knew that crucifixion was in his future. It was so horrific that even right before the cross, Jesus is praying, let this cup pass from me, right before his arrest. But the devil somehow knows. Something big is happening with you, and you need to be assured that God is on your side. But Jesus is ready for this from Deuteronomy 6, verse 16. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test as you tested him at Massah. You know what happened at Massah? In Exodus 17, the Israelites are just recently coming out of Egypt. They're coming into the wilderness. It's a new experience for them. They don't have water, right when they want it. They quarrel with Moses. They say, why did you bring us out to the desert so that our cattle and our kids and ourselves could just die from thirst? And Moses prays to God and says, God, they're about ready to stone me to death. What do you want me to do with these people? I mean, there's no water here. And God says, look, okay, take some elders, go to that rock over there, hit the rock, and water's going to come out. But that place gained a name, Massah and Meribah, which means testing and quarreling, because in Exodus 17, we're told, they ask this question, is the Lord among us or not? Because if he was, this is surely what he would do in this moment. So where's the confirmation that God loves me, that God's with me? Have you ever asked a question like that in your heart? I want you to step into the shoes of a Christian in the first century who has just been exposed to the Gospel of Matthew. You know, you've heard some stories about Jesus, you're a Christian, but then you hear that Matthew has written down this account of Jesus' life, and your church gets a copy of it, and a brother stands up to read the gospel in the assembly for the first time, and you hear about this experience that Jesus has in the wilderness. But imagine that you are a slave, and you're a slave in the house of a master who is terrible and treats you horribly and beats you constantly and uses your body for his personal pleasure, because that was not unheard of for Roman slaves. They didn't have a lot of rights. So your life is a wilderness, and you're hungry for a lot of things. Wouldn't you be tempted to ask in your life, is God actually with me or not? If he is, he would strike my master dead. I mean, he struck Ananias and Sapphira dead for lying about some cash. But my master does these kinds of horrible things to me, and his stocks are going up, and he's got perfect health, and everything's peachy for him. How does that make any sense whatsoever? Wouldn't it be tempting in that kind of lifestyle to give God an ultimatum and say, either you show up in some kind of big way and save me, or I'm just done. You know, I'm going to dispatch my master in the middle of the night, and I'm going to hop on the next ship to Tarshish. Because that always goes really well, hopping on ships to Tarshish. But then imagine you hear the Gospel of Matthew being read in your church. And you hear about how the Son of God, in a really hard, vulnerable moment, could have demanded that God show up. And he didn't. And he didn't do it for the rest of his life until the cross. Would that help you? If you were in that kind of position in your life in the first century, I think it would. It helped me. For you and me here, are we ever tempted to think, if God actually cared about me, if God actually cared about this person that I love, if he is actually at work in my life or their lives, and he would make it abundantly clear in fill-in-the-blank kind of way? You know, I mean, just to get really practical about this, we've all been praying for Ruby Brad for a long time now, and a lot of people have. Stephen and Renee keep sharing their updates. Dan and Ashley share those with us on Facebook, and as you know already, it is not looking good. I was reading an update from Stephen on the 19th. He said this: the only part of her body with no evidence of disease is her lower arms and hands. The neuroblastoma cancer cells are nearly everywhere, with significant manifestations in her liver, lungs, pancreas, pelvic lymph nodes, spine, bones, and blood. And on the 20th, he said this, "She ate most of one small taco last night for dinner, but her appetite is now officially gone." And I was reading an update just this morning on Facebook from him, and he was saying that her body is swelling up with liquid. She's retaining so much fluid because of the treatments, and they're trying to take care of that. And she's in a rough spot. I think Stephen and Renee are showing tremendous faith in how they're handling this, because 9-year-old girls should not have debilitating cancer. I recognize that it happens. It happens to a lot of people around the world, but it should not happen. There's something so unnatural and wrong about it. And I know that some of you have dealt with tragedies of your own. There are a lot of things that I don't understand about how God runs the universe and how he chooses to intervene and when he does that and how that all happens. I don't know and I don't understand how he interacts with our prayers. But what I do understand and what keeps me sane and grounded when I look at the world, when I look at people that I care about who are going through hard things, is that if God, of his own free will, sent his child into our wilderness to die in it for sins that he had nothing to do with, then that must mean he cares about all of us more than we can possibly fathom. And that must mean he is worthy of our complete trust. And that must mean we've got to be so careful to not try to box him in with demands and with tests. Because his own son didn't do that. Jesus had faith. Sometimes I don't think we think often enough about how Jesus himself had faith. But he did, and he shows that here. Third temptation of the devil is to say something basically like this. So you say that you're bringing in the kingdom of the heavens. Sounds pretty big, sounds pretty grand. Surely the devil heard what John was preaching, that Jesus is about to preach when he gets done with this wilderness thing. So you're bringing in this kingdom. Well, here's the thing. You can have the kingdom now if you want it. And you don't have to go through hard things in order to get there. You can have the spoils of war without the war. I'll give them to you. He took him to this high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world in verse 8. I don't know if this was Everest or not. I don't know what mountain this was. But can you imagine being up there and seeing this panoramic view of all of these riches and all these thrones and all these different peoples, nations, and languages, and the devil saying, "This is all mine. And I will make you the ruler of it if you compromise and recognize me as your overlord." I think that the devil probably had all this to offer. In John chapter 12, verse 31, Jesus calls him the ruler of this world. He was the ruler of this world. And there's no reason to suppose that the devil would have reneged on this offer. He would have been more than happy to have Jesus as an ally and subordinate in his plan to wreck God's good creation and rebel against him in every way that he could. But you know, Jesus was already promised all the kingdoms of the world. You go back to Psalm 2, which we are repeatedly going back to. Psalm 2 is a major, major touchstone for the life and the work of Jesus Christ. Psalm 2, God says, "Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall rule them with a rod of iron. Dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel." You're going to have the kingdoms of the world, Jesus. But the devil offers a shortcut to the power and the glory that was going to be his if he went to the cross and suffered in the way that the Father had planned. But again, Jesus is ready. From that same area of Deuteronomy 6, just a few verses before the previous quote, he quotes again and says, "It's the Lord your God that you shall fear. Him you shall serve. By his name you shall swear." There is no compromise that is worth giving up your allegiance to the true God to worship someone else. So he resists all of this because he understood, even when he was insanely hungry, even when he was at this moment where he wanted so much, he recognized that there's no shortcuts. He refused to bypass the hardship that lay ahead of him going to the cross. We need to ask ourselves, is that our mindset too? Or am I looking for the shortcuts? Am I trying to avoid suffering in all its forms, any way that I can? We live in a culture where that is the way people think. That is the way people live. I got pain, I'm going to take a Tylenol. I've got a relationship problem, I'm just going to cut off that relationship because that person distresses me. I've got any kind of problem, I'm going to minimize it, I'm going to box it away, I'm going to get rid of it any way that I can. Is that the way that we should be as God's people? There are plenty of things that Jesus has told you to do and me to do that are hard. Are we going to do them? Or are we going to shortcut? I hope this gives you something to think about this week, as it does for me. Let me encourage you that when you are hungry, when you are devastated, when you are upset, when you're frustrated, when it's hard to think, and whenever I'm really, really hungry, it's hard for me to think, what is your soul going to grab for? Let me encourage you to grab for the same thoughts, fundamental, foundational thoughts that Jesus grabbed for, that the Lord is my Lord. I'm not going to worship anybody else. I'm not going to put him to the test. I'm not going to make my own food and try to get out of it. I'm going to cling to his words. All of that has to be at the base and the center and the core and whatever other metaphor you want to use for your soul. And if that's true for you and me, we're going to be okay. So let's stand up and let's sing the song that Brent selected.